Hey everyone, I'm Jason V, and this is Local Color, a Baltimore podcast. My guest today is artist Lu Zhang. Lu was born in Chongqing, China, but grew up in Stillwater, a small college town in Oklahoma. After receiving her BFA in General Fine Arts from the Maryland Institute College of Art, she attended the Frank Mohr Institute in the Netherlands, where she got her MFA in painting. Lu currently lives and works in Baltimore, but her art has been exhibited all around the world in France, the Netherlands, and right here in Baltimore and in Washington, D.C. Lu, welcome to Local Color.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. The weather is, obviously, it's a little warm for December, but I'm not going to complain because I hate the winter.
Yeah, agreed.
You don't like the winter?
No.
Okay.
I like having seasons, but I don't love the winter.
I agree. I think that people that live maybe out in the West or in the South, if they've lived there all their life, they don't really understand seasons, but I need seasons. I need rain every once in a while. And now that I'm older, snow just doesn't do if I don't work because it's snowing, it's like I'm not getting paid.
Yeah,
you know. But if you're in school or something like that, it could snow all semester.
Yeah.
So let's get started. Oklahoma is a pretty it's a pretty far cry from China. How did you end up there?
So my dad was in school in China, and he it's kind of a long story, but after the Cultural Revolution, there was I'm gonna pause and frame my.
No, that's fine.
So after the Cultural Revolution, during the Cultural Revolution, there was a pause in testing. So they call them admissions tests for college, and all Chinese students who want to go to college take these tests, and they're placed at a university based on their scores. And my dad actually tested very well and was able to go to a school that ended up sending him to the U.S. to study abroad. And of course, things in the U.S., the conditions were a lot better. So he ended up staying. And so we lived in Stillwater, Oklahoma until I was about, elementary school aged, and then we ended up moving to Oklahoma City.
How was Oklahoma City compared to Stillwater?
It was bigger, more suburban, I guess, actually, because Stillwater is a pretty small town. A few more Walmarts and a few more Targets, but fairly similar.
It's like typical Midwest life?
Yeah, very typical Midwest life.
Okay. How long? So you moved to Oklahoma. How old were you when you guys moved from China?
I was 4 years old.
So do you really remember anything of China?
I have a few pretty clear memories, actually, moments that I remember. But I wouldn't say that I have a overall memory of China.
Gotcha. Now, have you experienced any problems, or is it like, do you consider yourself a first generation American?
Yeah, I guess so. I was so young when I moved here.
Okay. Did you ever have problems when you moved from China to Oklahoma adjusting to American life, or being, becoming a product of American culture, though you had parents from another country?
Yeah, I would say that was probably pretty crucial to my makeup and kind of figuring out my identity growing up. I didn't speak English for the first probably 2 years, and I was going to public school, and I think I was in an ESL class. So I think there was a period in time where my teachers just had no idea if I was smart or capable or competent, because I couldn't communicate at all. And that was very frustrating. I don't have clear memories of how frustrating that was, but I imagine that was a hard time.
So then as you got older, let's say teenage and high school, did you ever have, within the household, did you have culture clashes with you and your parents?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you give me
some example? Well, I mean, I think one thing that happens is when people immigrate, like my parents held on to fairly conservative values that my relatives in China kind of moved away from a little bit. So, I mean, it was, there were just different ideas of, you know, how I should spend my time. I should be studying all the time. I shouldn't have boyfriends. I should be focusing on school, things like that. And I was a fairly rebellious teenager, so that was a difficult time for us. But you know, now, of course, everything changes when you don't live at home anymore.
Do your parents still live in Oklahoma?
Yeah, they do.
Oh, really? Okay. When did you leave for?
I left in, let's see, 2001, so after I graduated high school, and I moved to Baltimore to attend MICA.
Okay.
So that was when I moved away.
Gotcha. And you've just lived in Baltimore ever since?
Yeah, I've pretty much lived in Baltimore. There was a short hiatus where I moved to China for, it was supposed to be 1 year. I ended up staying for 6 months. I had a really hard time with the pollution there and actually got very sick and kept getting like coughs and lung issues. So I cut that trip short. But so there was the 6 months in China, and then I went to grad school for 2 years in the Netherlands.
What were you, did you go back to Chongqing in China, or did you go to another city?
I was in Chongqing. I traveled some. So I went to Shanghai and Beijing and Xi'an. But for the most part, I stayed in Chongqing.
Now, I think that what Europeans, how they think of America, I think is how Americans might think of China. Just how far, like where exactly is Chongqing in relation to everything else in China?
So Chongqing is probably, if you think of it as a triangle, there's like Beijing in the north, and then Shanghai is in the southeast, and Chongqing is more towards the center of the country,
really,
a little bit towards
inland?
The south. Yeah, it's inland. But it's off of, it's where the Yangtze River, well, not ends, but it's downriver. So if you actually take a cruise from mm-hmm. Shanghai, you end up in Chongqing at some point.
Okay. Now, when you were there, or what am I trying to say? Because you moved from China when you said you were four, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when in those early years when you were in Oklahoma, or actually that doesn't even matter. So in Chongqing, I know that there's two dominant languages in China. Did they speak, was it Cantonese or Mandarin?
They speak Mandarin, but there's kind of a local dialect, which is, when I was growing up, it used to be called Sichuanhua, but since then, Chongqing is now a municipality, so now it's called Chongqinghua.
Interesting.
But it's a kind of a dialect of Mandarin, but for someone not from the area, it's very hard to understand. It's much more dramatic than, say, having like a Southern accent or having a Boston accent. It's really hard to actually make out what people are saying if you're not familiar.
Okay, gotcha. So when did you learn that you were interested in art and painting?
I think it was something that I always kind of dabbled in. I was, you know, when offered electives, I always took the art elective. But I think part of the reason I went to high school was, or not high school, part of the reason I went to art school was maybe still an extension of the rebellion that I was in. But, you know, at some point I did realize that this could be something that I did professionally in some capacity.
Now, was it always painting, or did it start with like drawing or maybe sculptures?
Yeah, it started more with drawing, and I still don't actually make paintings. Like, my degree is in painting, but that's more of the program's kind of historical connection to the founder. So I make drawings, and I still consider my practice to be largely an extension of drawing.
Did your parents support your decision to go to art school and be an artist?
Not really. I mean, I would say that, again, I was so difficult in high school that they didn't push me too hard about it. And I think they had hoped that I would go into graphic design or something that they thought would be more practical.
So even in the 80s or 90s when you were in high school, they saw the benefits of of graphic design, because I feel like a lot of just parents in general just don't want their kids to get a liberal arts education. Like, everybody wants their kids to be an engineer or a doctor or something, but not all kids can handle those kind of things. Like me, for example, if I'm sick or if I'm bleeding, it's fine. Like, it's my own blood. But if I see someone else's, like, like, if I see someone else throw up, I'm like, all right, yeah, I need to leave or else I'm just going to throw up. This is gross.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. No, my parents, I mean, I would say that their acceptance of graphic design was a compromise, right? So it wasn't like, you know, if I were in high school and I said, I want to be a graphic designer, it's not like they would have been okay with that. The expectation was that I would be a doctor, and I have a similar aversion to blood and, and bodily fluids. So yeah, the compromise for them in high school, their thinking of it was that I could go to law school and I could be a lawyer. So I get where you're coming from with that.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad for me. Like, my mom is a nurse, so there was a time where I did want to be a nurse, but then I saw what they actually did and I was like, yeah, you guys got that. But my girlfriend, she is like, her mom is American, but her dad is Nigerian. And I think that is just a common theme with first generation mm-hmm. kids with their parents. It's like your parents want you to do well, but it's like they kind of want you to do well a little more just for their benefit. Like, just so that they can tell people, like, well, my daughter's a doctor. What does your daughter do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is because, I mean, my parents absolutely have made huge sacrifices, you mm-hmm. know, and I think that, you know, having Chinese parents, there's always been an emphasis on education and the importance of education. So, you know, for them, I feel like it is like, oh, like, what do you mean you didn't even apply to go to Princeton? what is that about? You didn't even try to go there, you know? And my parents actually took me to Princeton so I could see it.
Yeah, and you're like,
I really like
the buildings.
Yeah, but yeah. I think they thought that would persuade me. And I was kind of like, no. I mean, we were on our way to NYU because I was interested in NYU. And we kind of stopped in Princeton, and the idea was like, you could have had this, and the concept was totally lost on me. But yeah, I think, you know, I think when parents make sacrifices, there's an expectation that, and I mean, I wouldn't say that it even comes out of an ego or anything like that. It's they honestly believe that that's what's best for you, and they and I mean, it's a great privilege actually for me to say, to be able to choose a liberal arts education, because it is a gamble, you know? Like, it's not like I make a lot of money. I'm probably never going to make a lot of money. But, you know, when my parents really pushed me to be a doctor or go to law school, what they really were asking for is for me to have access to the stability of all of that. And so it's more the unknowns and the insecurity and all of that about being an artist or any kind of creative endeavor, or being an artist or a musician or a writer or, you know, radio maybe.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, my parents, they were supportive, but they were just like, I hope you realize that the road that you're taking is not an easy one. But I think that's where it comes from, is that you don't really care that it's not easy. It's just what you want to do. Because I'm sure that being an engineer and being a doctor definitely isn't easy, but there are some people who want to do that. But I think at the same time, art and creativity and just the creative arts in general, they do help people in a way. Like, art can be therapeutic, or radio or television, or really anything. It can be entertaining. And I think that entertainment is kind of a negative connotation, because when you think entertainment, you think like TMZ and viral videos on YouTube or Facebook and stuff. But I mean, think of all of the museums and observatories and stuff like that in the nation. I mean, even the national park system. The national park system is designed so that people can go to places and look at holes in the ground and go, wow, that's really neat. You know what I mean? But that part of the brain that is acknowledging the beauty of the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone National Park, that's the same part of the brain that like your imagination, you know, I think that should be cultivated as much as the more analytical or methodical parts of the brain, like where math or science is involved. I think art is just as important. And speaking of art, let's talk about some of your projects. What medium do you mainly work in?
I honestly don't have a main medium. So for almost every project I do, I do some research to, figure out the best way to create what I want. Maybe it's helpful to think of a specific example, but I think across my work, I've worked with architectural models, I've worked with text, I've worked with video mapping and video projections, and honestly, I didn't find that to be very rewarding.
Video mapping?
It's stupidly complicated. It's actually not, but to do it is complicated. Basically, when we look at a video, if it's the projector is projected straight, it's a rectangle, right? The issue is if you want some projections to be a different shape, there's all these things that happen, like in the vertices where you have to start moving points around.
As soon as you said vertices, my brain was like, too much math, too much.
Well, and the thing is, I don't even know if any of those words are correct, because I basically, learned it enough to make it happen for this like specific project I needed it to happen for. So, I think I know a lot about a lot of, or no, I know a little about a lot of different things.
From what I've seen, because I looked at some of your work online, and I went to the Peabody to look at your most recent exhibit, and we'll get to that in a moment. But from what I've seen from looking at your work, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, a lot of your work deals with the themes of like history and repetition and travel. What draws you to those themes? If you agree with my assertion.
Yeah. I think I would agree with that. Maybe not necessarily, I guess I wouldn't use the word travel necessarily, but I think that's in there, and that I am interested in history and memory and place and the movement between those things. So the travel comes in. And some of the work that I made before this project that's at the Peabody Library, but for the 2 years when I was in graduate school, I thought of that work as being kind of, or I thought of myself as being nomadic at that point. So it was important for me that that work could fit into a small suitcase. I think thinking about place and how I move through place is important. And also time, kind of as an overarching experience.
So what are some of the pieces that you made while you were in... let's back up first. What was grad school like in the Netherlands? And I guess what were the Netherlands like in general?
Yeah, so it was an interesting experience. So I wanted to go to grad school. I'd wanted to go for probably 4 years before I actually went. It was a matter of saving up the money and finding the right school and being able to commit to it and to spend the time. So I chose to go to school in the Netherlands largely for financial reasons. I was able to attend graduate school for less money than I would pay to go in-state in Maryland.
Wow.
Because the Dutch government subsidized my education in a way that the American government doesn't. The Netherlands was interesting because it's a much... it's not actually even a richer country, but, it's more egalitarian and people there tend to be middle class. You don't see the poverty you see here and you don't see the extreme wealth that you see here.
Everyone's a little middle of the road.
Maybe not everyone. I think there is a lot of segregation. Mm-hmm. But there's also just more social systems that... offer stipends for people that need it. So people's basic needs are met. People have health care. I don't know the homeless rate there, but I didn't have... Yeah, I experienced that differently than I do in Baltimore and other cities in the U.S.
Talk to me about your piece Funeral Wreath. I thought that one was pretty interesting. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so Funeral Wreath was a part of a series I did that was exhibited at the Grimaldus Gallery in Baltimore on Charles Street. And that was the series I did right before I went to grad school. Funeral Wreath is kind of a large wreath form, a circular form that is made out of thousands and thousands of circles of aluminum foil, little circles of aluminum foil that were then like kind of tufted and glued onto this base. And the idea behind it was, I mean, maybe going back to your question of growing up in Oklahoma and my experience as a first generation American. When we lived in Stillwater, I was living on a college campus because my dad was in school, and we lived in like kind of dorm housing, but for families. So there were these mini apartments, and my mother would cover the whole kitchen, like the stove and the backsplash, all of that with aluminum foil. She would like tape it up because our cooking is stir frying. So there's a lot of like grease and oil that gets everywhere, and it didn't make sense to like have to clean it. So there was aluminum foil everywhere. And that was something that as a child I recognized as being different from the experiences of American children. So the wreath, in a way, is a monument to my mother. The technique that I used to make it was something that my mother and I did to make a diorama for school projects with tissue paper. Like we used to make, or I would have an assignment of making like a miniature parade float. So, yeah, it's kind of a combination of that kind of technique from my childhood and my experience of the aluminum foil processed into this kind of object that I see as a monument to my mother.
So where does the funeral part come in now? I know you said a monument, and I think a monument is something of like a remembrance, but is your mom still alive?
My mom is still alive. Prior to making that piece, my father-in-law had passed away. So I think I was thinking about kind of death and grieving and maybe almost prematurely grieving for, you know, what is going to be taking place in the future, inevitably. But yeah, I think I play that part down because my mother is very superstitious. And so she doesn't really know about this piece.
Sorry, Mom. Okay, we'll make sure that she just can never listen to this episode.
Yeah, she's not internet savvy.
So then it doesn't even matter. Oh, okay, cool. All right, now let's talk about your exhibit at the George Peabody Library down in Mount Vernon. The time that I went to go see it, that's the first time that I've ever been there.
Yeah.
And I've lived in Baltimore my entire life. Beautiful place. Obviously, I think like everyone who's ever been there, I wish that people had access to the upper levels. So how did you, when you did the cover for the Be More Art magazine, did you just ask them to take a picture up there? How did that happen?
No, I've actually been working up there. So I have a studio. Yeah, it's interesting. So I've had people come through the show, and so many people say they didn't know that they could come in there. They thought it was kind of just for Hopkins students. But it is open to the public, and it's a viewing library. So you can't take the books out, but you can request to see any book that's in the collection. And Paul Espinoza, the book's curator there, will bring you the book. I was kind of given maybe more space to explore the collection and to roam around the stacks. And, you know, that kind of came out of months of working with Paul and kind of developing a trust that I would be careful with the materials and respectful of the space.
Cool. So let's talk about your current exhibit there.
So the exhibition is called Topologue Typologue, and it is kind of a collaboration between Paul Espinoza and myself. ICA Baltimore, which is a kind of a nomadic curatorial body directed by Lou Joseph, helped me with kind of putting together the exhibition and then curating other books around it. So the books that I've produced for the library live on this little book cart that if you enter the space, the books are on display now, but you would have access to them as they exist on the cart.
Now, I looked up separately the definition of topology or topology and typology, and they kind of – they don't have similar definitions, but I feel like their definitions have similar characteristics. Like, I think topology essentially is like the study of – I don't want to say terrain, like geography, but it has to do with destination, where you are, where mm-hmm. things are. And then typology, I think, has to do – it's kind of the same, but it has to do more with – words and letters, I think. Can you explain why you named it topology, typology?
Yeah.
Or topologue, typologue.
Yeah. So it's also a play on topograph and typograph, like topography. But yeah, you're right. So typology is maybe more the classification of things, the sorting. And then topology, I was definitely thinking of what I used to do when I worked in architecture. I used to build these models and basically terrain, as you mentioned, kind of cutting out layers and gluing them on top of each other to create, you know, in a resemblance of a mountain or a hill or a valley. So I was thinking about that in terms of the architecture of the library and how you would, what would happen if you almost saw the interior of the library as a landscape.
Now, there in the exhibit, there's six books, but I think, aren't there only five floors in the piece?
There's six floors?
Yeah. Oh, wow. That place is a lot bigger than I thought. Can you take me through what each of the six books represent?
Yeah, so the books, the content from each book is sourced from a particular level of the library as kind of dictated by the Dewey Decimal System. So it's based on the subject classification. The first book is on general reference. The second book is on biography. The third book is on history. The fourth book is on language, literature, and translation. The fifth book is on science and art. And the sixth book is on bibliography, or books about books.
Yeah, I noticed that when I was looking through the sixth book that there were a set of, because the sixth books are kind of like the drawers of the Dewey Decimal System mm-hmm. or in a library. There were parts of those cards that were in, I think, was it the second book? You opened it up and had the two books, and one uh-huh. of them was like a story telling the story of Don Quixote. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that again in the sixth book. The one I was most curious about is, I think, the fourth book with the molds explain that to me.
Yeah. Maybe it's helpful if I go through kind of generally what each book looks like or how it was made. So the first book, again, is on general reference. And so all of those images are monoprints made from Xeroxes that I took of encyclopedias and kind of different, again, general reference materials on the first floor of the library. And then those are kind of strung together into a new story. The second book is on Don Quixote, as you mentioned, and that I selected Don Quixote because the Peabody Library has a huge Don Quixote collection of over, I think, 400 volumes. So it's something that they talk about a lot, so I thought it was important for me to engage it as well. The Don Quixote book, it's basically chapter headings strung together as a story. So, and the chapter headings are so descriptive.
Yeah, exactly.
That it gives you room as the reader to kind of place yourself in the situation or kind of make up a little bit more of the story and use your imagination. The third book on history, those are digital scans of different surfaces within the library. And they're put together in an accordion fold book so that you can pull apart the book or pull out the book and see a very long horizon line. Again, thinking about landscape and taking a stroll through the space of the library. And underneath of those images is a transcription of a tour that Paul has given. I think it was in May 2014. And it's a very detailed tour where he talks about the history of the library and the history of the collection. So thinking about kind of layers of history in that book. And the fourth book, which you asked about specifically, is on language, literature, and translation. And those are impressions that I made with polymer clay, which is like Sculpey, of different architectural elements within the building. And then I placed them in kind of thinking about an alphabet. So thinking about translating architecture into a writing system. And actually, you can download that font. If you wanted to type in the George Peabody font.
Oh, okay, cool.
So the fifth book is on the weather.
I remember that one. That one was my favorite one, but continue.
Yeah, so that floor of the library is science and art. And I was thinking about, I don't know if you've ever seen this documentary. It's called The Overview Effect. It's pretty short. But it talks about this idea of people seeing the Earth suspended in space for the first time, being able to see like the entirety of the Earth. And there's an astronaut that's quoted as saying from space, there's an astronaut that's quoted as saying that from space, the sky looks like a line. So I was thinking about kind of the shape of the sky in that book. And so what they are, there's, I think, 63 cyanotypes. So they're photograms that were made in the library. And it's basically paper that has a chemical solution on it that's light sensitive. So I placed the paper on the windowsills of the library, and then I found different objects in the collection and detritus in the offices and placed those to basically make prints. And the text that goes along with those images in the book is Luke Howard's speech on naming the clouds. So he was the first to develop a nomenclature for clouds. And then the sixth book is the bibliography for all of the books. And it's also everything that was remaining in my studio after I was done with the first five books. So all of those are chopped up into catalog card-sized cards and laid out in a box.
Oh, yeah. I noticed some of them in the box. They're just like blank. Or they were just, it seemed like there were pictures that were out of place. I understood that it was a catalog or a filing system, but I couldn't put together what all of the books meant as a whole. I remember reading, you know, the placard next to the exhibit and matching up the books to which theme, but overall, you wanted to, I guess, capture the spirit of the Peabody Library in a series of books.
I would say my initial aim was to make a project that belonged in the space.
Gotcha.
So thinking about, I think originally I was thinking about like site specificity, but in the end it was maybe more about even the documentation of, you know, me being in the space and the process of producing this work, the process of working with Paul. In the sixth book, so there are blank cards. And maybe for me, those were more about just the material of the cards itself. So kind of the shift between material and language and content. And there's also entries on different kind of subject topics that I took from Wikipedia.
How do you feel that once the exhibit has run its course, it will become a part of the Peabody collection? Are you proud of that?
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. So I think that's maybe what I think is maybe my biggest achievement in the project, is that it did become a part of the collection, or it has become a part of the collection, and it exists as the other books within the collection do. You know, I'm not showing the work in a white cube gallery. It exists in this place, and it is subject to all of the processes that happen there and kind of the rhythm of the space.
Well, now, what about future projects? You working on anything now?
No. I'm taking a break. I'm going to be giving some tours of the space, so the project isn't over yet. But I like this new way of working. So I like this idea of approaching an institution or approaching someone that actually has resources. To when we started, maybe before you started recording, we were talking about your studio here and how amazing it is to have access to a studio like this. And so I'm really interested in that, finding these systems that could be supportive of artists that maybe aren't aware that they could be supportive of artists. And finding people that are willing to collaborate to make these projects happen that can be kind of mutually beneficial. You know, so many people have gone into the library, yourself included, that hadn't before. And I think that's something that Paul is excited about, the George Peabody Library is excited about, the larger umbrella of Johns Hopkins University is excited about. And of course, I had the opportunity to make work there. I think I'm interested in finding more connections like this. Oh, and I also want to say that we're talking about having this residency be kind of ongoing and formalizing it so that artists can apply with the goal of producing a project over the course of a year.
Now, during your residency there, did you live there or like did you just live?
No, it's a studio residency. So I just had a studio there on the fifth floor.
Did you live close by?
I do live close by, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And cool. Actually, one thing that was interesting is in book one, where I sourced images from encyclopedias, and also I found things like architectural plans of the library itself. I found plans for HVAC, and the engineers that produced those plans, their office was in the building where I live now.
Really?
Yeah. So that's included in the book as kind of a note to It's a Small World.
Yeah, I was gonna say a little bit of history there.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. You got anything else you want to mention we haven't gone over?
No, I don't think so. Oh, I do want to say that the project was supported by a Ruby's grant from the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance. And that really helped me. I mean, the project wouldn't have happened without the support of that grant.
Gotcha. Well, Lou, I want to thank you for sitting down with me today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
No problem. You can learn more about Lou and her work by visiting her website, luzhang.com. Follow her on Instagram at zhanglux. Follow Local Color on Instagram at LocalColorABP and on Twitter at LocalColor410. You can also find us on Facebook. I'm Jason V, and this is Local Color, a Baltimore podcast. You did a good job.
Thanks.